الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على أشرف الأنبياء والمرسلين محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. It's a great pleasure to be here. There was a delay, and it makes me think. Sometimes people doubt in the ruling, the fiqh ruling that we have for traveling. They say, you know, modern times make travel so easy. There's no reason to pray qasr anymore, and no reason for all this, all these special accommodations for travelers. And as soon as you travel once, you realize how difficult travel is. Even in a plane, it's no less taxing to fly than it is to drive or walk or take a camel. Or maybe not, no less chance, but it is taxing anyway. But alhamdulillah, I'm here. I would like to begin today's lecture and spend some time today speaking about the month itself. Is the mic working, or am I just talking? Is there a mic that's bringing the sound to you? Okay. So first of all, today is the first of the new year, right? This is the eve of the first. I don't know if you saw the moon. I saw the moon driving in. It was over one of the towers, the Freedom Tower. So it was very, very beautiful coming in. So this is the beginning of the first month. And because of that, there are certain blessings that come with it, and there are certain prayers as well. So I'd like to start by sharing one of the du'as that's been narrated for the first night, and we can go through that a little bit. Then I want to speak about a tradition that we have from the 8th Imam, Imam Ridha alayhi salam, where he speaks about, please salawat. So he speaks in this hadith about the importance of this night and these first 10 days. And so I want to share that with you as well. I like to go through that on an annual basis during the first night of Muharram. It's a good reminder of what we're doing here, and it really sets the tone well, I think. So let's start with a supplication. The Imams say, Allahumma anta al-ilahul qadeem wa hadhihi sanatun jadeeda fa as'aluka fiha al-ismata min ash-shaytan wal-quwwata ala hadhihi an-nafs al-ammarati bis-su' والاشتغال بما يقربني إليك يا كريم يا ذا الجلال والإكرام. O God, you are our everlasting God, and this is a new year. Therefore, I implore you to grant me protection from Satan, to strengthen me against my carnal soul, which invites me to evil, and to engage me in that which brings me near to you, O generous one, O possessor of might and kindness. So New Year's in different cultures has different significance. It's almost always a time for renewal and a time for resolutions and taking account of the past and making plans and kind of setting your aspirations for the coming year. So similar for us as well. It's been clouded now by the event of Ashura, but from the time of the Prophet and even probably pre-Islamically, this was a significant time. And we see just as we're in New York, so the apple, does the apple still fall, or is something else now that falls? It's still an apple or a ball, whatever it is. I remember growing up and you know, waiting and watching and cutting up confetti and doing all sorts of things like that. So for this New Year as well, there's significance, there's blessing. And so this dua helps us to set the right kinds of resolutions for the coming year. Not frivolous resolutions, but rather those things that are most important and most significant for the coming year. Protection from those things that are most threatening to our well-being, and then guidance toward that which is most beneficial for us. So our two worst enemies, one is external satanic forces, whether it's in the form of Iblis himself and Satan himself, or other kinds of external forces that are also termed by the Quran also shaytan, shayateen wal jinni wal ins. And so these external forces are there that are constantly tempting us and distracting us from what's good and making things that are evil seem good. And then we have our internal force as well. It's not all, we can't put all the blame on external forces. We have our own soul, which is carnal and base and pulls us towards things that are ungodly. And if left unchecked, leads us to evil. And so those are the two things that we want to seek protection from. And then we want to engage in the coming year. Our aspiration is, help me to do those things that are going to be most beneficial for me. Right? Those things that are going to bring me closer to you, which is the ultimate goal. right, with prayer and fasting and even these gatherings, sometimes we lose sight of the ultimate goal, but the ultimate goal is always closeness to Allah, right? The prayer itself is only a means to that end. Even these gatherings of Muharram are only a means to that end, right? So those are some important pointers that the Imam puts into this the supplication for the new year. The tradition from Imam Ridha alayhi salam, this is from him to one of his companions named Ar-Rayyan ibn Shabib. So Ar-Rayyan ibn Shabib, the Imam, he lived in the Abbasid era, just after the famous and infamous Harun al-Rashid of 1001 Nights infamy. So the Imam is living in this time when the Abbasids are ruling, and this Ar-Rayyan ibn Shabib is actually from the ruling family. He's one of the Abbasids. But secretly, he's a Shi'i. Right? So he comes to the Imam secretly, and he learns from him, and this is one of the exchanges that they have in private, far from the ears of court spies. So Ar-Rayyan ibn Shabib, he says, "I entered the presence of Ar-Ridha on the first day of Muharram, a day like tomorrow. He asked, 'Ibn Shabib, are you fasting?' I replied, 'No.' He said, 'This day is the day on which Zechariah petitioned his Lord, saying, Lord, grant me righteous progeny out of your grace. You are the hearer of prayers. God answered his prayer and ordered the angel to announce to Zechariah, while he yet stood in the sanctuary, that God gives you glad tidings of John, of Yahya. Thus, whoever fasts on this day and then petitions God, God will answer him as he answered Zechariah." All right, so it puts a kind of a time frame on this time of the year as well. So tomorrow, it matches up with this special event. So Zechariah, you're probably familiar with the story that's told in several parts of the Quran, but particularly in Ali Imran, the third surah, and also in Surah Maryam, in the 19th surah. And so the story is that Mary was under the care of Zechariah, and once she came of age, he had made a special place for her near the sanctuary of the Temple of David. And she could engage in worship there. No one had access to her except for him as her caretaker. She was the only woman in that area. He was the only man who had access as her uncle, not a mahram, but as an uncle. He had gained this access by Allah's will. And so he'd go and visit her, and take care of her, make sure she had food and whatever else she needed. And the Quran tells us he would go into her chamber, which again was sealed off and no one had access to it, and he would find food already provided for her. And the traditions say that it would be out of season food even. The miraculous nature of it was that winter fruits would be there in the summer and summer in the winter. And so Zechariah asks Mary where she got the food from, and she says that Allah provided the food for her. And she reminds him that, "Inna Allaha yarzuqu man yasha'u bighayri hisab." Allah provides sustenance to whomever he wishes without any sort of reckoning. So when Zechariah hears this, he gets inspired to offer his own prayer. He's old, he's heirless, he's one of the major, I'm not sure if he's the head of the temple or one of the major priests of the temple, but he sees that there are people who are poised to take his position and use it for evil once he's out of the picture, once he's died. And so he wants to make sure that that doesn't happen, and he has his own heir that he can have influence over, train, and that heir can take his position and make sure that corruption doesn't leak into the institution. And so he uses this. He's old, his wife is old, they've been barren, they haven't had any children. And he gets inspired by Mary's reminder of God's grace. And immediately, he's in the sanctuary already, he turns to Allah and he prays. And he asks for, "Rabbi habli min ladunka waliya," give me an heir, give me a successor who will be there after me. And the Quran itself tells us that immediately, as soon as he prayed, he was still standing, and he had just finished his prayer when Allah sends Gabriel. Right, so it makes a point to mention that the immediacy of that response that comes with any prayer. Every prayer is answered, right? But how it's answered and how fast it's answered, all that depends on so many things. And one of the things it depends on is the sincerity of the supplicator. And in this case, he was very sincere, and he was someone of that caliber of a prophet. And Allah immediately answers his prayer and sends the angel to tell him that you're going to have a son and he'll be named Yahya. It's a unique name that no one has been given before. So this matches up with this day. There are lots of connections between Yahya and Imam Hussein that are earmarked in our hadith as well. This is one connection, that these days that are earmarked for Imam Hussein and his commemoration, they ended up falling in the same time frame as this event from history of Zechariah praying for Yahya's birth. There's a tradition that tells us that that Zechariah was reminded or taught the names of the Ahlul Bayt, right? So the Prophet and his family, Ali, Fatima, Hassan, Hussein, these five members of the Ahlul Bayt, we have traditions that take us all the way back to Adam's time and tell us that each of the prophets knew, just like they knew all the successors and all the prophets who would come, and they knew all the ones that had gone in the past. They're all a part of one single institution of divine guidance. And so the names of the Ahlul Bayt were taught to the prophets, and sometimes they would even use them as means of intercession towards God, to pray through them and through their grace to get closer to Allah. And so when Zechariah is taught the names of the Ahlul Bayt, the tradition tells us that he uttered their names and he felt this sort of spiritual joy from their names. Except for this one name, and when he recited it, he felt sadness overcome him. Right? He's very sensitive, spiritually pure, and so people like that, they're much more attuned to these kinds of things than you and I would be. And so he notices this heaviness and the sadness with the mention of this one name, and he asks Allah or Gabriel, I can't remember the traditions, if it's directly to Allah or Gabriel, but he asks him, what's the reason for this one name being a cause of sadness and the other one's causing me joy? And so then Allah tells him the story of Imam Hussein. It was Hussein's name that was like this. And he tells him the whole story, what will happen, and Zechariah, he feels very affected by the story. He ends up asking Allah, he's almost questioning Allah, and he says, how is it that the best of creatures, Muhammad, that he is going to be tried in this way, that you're going to give him a son? We use that term son, the Prophet himself used son, even though he's his grandson actually, but he uses the term son for him, for his grandchildren as well, Imam Hassan, Imam Hussein. And so how is it that the best of creation will be tried in this way and be subjected to this kind of pain and suffering through the death of his grandson, of his son? And he's kind of in wonder at how this could be. Then his reaction is to have his own aspiration to be like the Prophet. Right? This aspiration is amazing. He's not content just to be an observer and say, well, this is going to happen to the Prophet, I feel sorry for him. But rather, he wants to be as much like the Prophet as he can. There's an infinite gap between any of us and the Prophet, but his aspiration is there nonetheless. And so he says that just as you're going to subject that Prophet, the greatest of all creation, to that kind of suffering, I want you to subject me to the same kind of suffering. So grant me a son also, and let that son be beloved to me just as that son Hussein is going to be beloved to the Prophet, and then take my son from me like you're going to take that son from him, so that I can also experience the same suffering and then hopefully attain some of some of those stations that Prophet is destined for, that I can also have the opportunity and the challenge to be able to acquire that, some of those stations myself. And so Allah answers his prayer and gives him Zechariah during this time of the first of Muharram. The traditions also tell us that the gestation period for both is the same. They're both born after 6 months of gestation, which is a miraculous sort of an occurrence as well. So there are these sorts of similarities that are there. Their death also was similar. They both died at the hands of tyrants. Zechariah was killed as part of a twisted kind of bridal gift. Similar to the biblical story, we also have traditions that relate to a similar story, that he was killed at the whim of a woman that the king wanted to please, and so he had him killed and his head presented to the woman on a platter. And of course we know Imam Hussein's story as well. So these are some of the events that took place on this first of Muharram. And so the Imam, he questions Rayyan and says, are you fasting on this day? And when he says no, he says, you should, this is a day to fast. Right, so that's advice for us as well, that tomorrow is a great day to fast. And there's some prayers also that are there for the day, some simple prayers. And he even tells us that any supplication you make on this day, it's answered the way the prayer of Zechariah was answered. Then he said, Ibn Shabib, Muharram is a month in which the Arabs of old, from the age of ignorance, would forbid transgression and fighting because of its sanctity. Yet this nation of Muslims has not realized its sanctity, or the sanctity of their prophet. In this very month they slaughtered his progeny, captured his womenfolk, and pillaged his belongings. May God never forgive them for this. All right, so then he transitions to the significance of Muharram. So, most likely this is, the significance of Muharram is something that dates back to the beginning of time. The Quran tells us that, إِنَّ عِدَّةَ الشُّهُورِ عِنْدَ اللَّهِ 12 شَهْرًا فِي كِتَابِ اللَّهِ مِنْهَا أَرْبَعَةٌ حُرُمٌ. That the number of months in Allah's in Allah's kind of ordainment is 12 months, and four of them are these sacred months, these sanctified months, Muharram being the last of them. Rajab being on its own, separate from the others, and then three contiguous months, Dhul-Qa'dah, Dhul-Hijjah, and then Muharram. So the Hijjah, the last month of the calendar, is of course the month of Hajj. And so this was that was made as a sacred month where fighting had to cease and transgression, aggression had to cease to let people go for pilgrimage. So even if you're in the middle of a war, in the middle of some sort of a thing, you'd have to put your fights aside, have a truce for this time. And then the month before and the month after were to give people a chance to get to Mecca and get back from Mecca to their home before they had to go back to their whatever the fighting was that they weren't able to settle, if they weren't able to settle it. And so this month had that kind of sanctity where transgression of any kind was prohibited, at least aggression, right? Defensive warfare was permitted, and even now in Islam it is permitted as a defensive warfare, but not offensive. And so he says this was the significance of Muharram even in the Jahiliyyah. Jahiliyyah, before Islam, the traditions were there. We had the kind of relics of Abrahamic teachings as well. But he says, what a shame that after the Prophet came, enlightened people with Islam, the people who had observed the sanctity of the month before Islam failed to observe it after Islam. And the irony is that not only did they fail to observe it despite the fact that they're a Muslim, but they failed to observe it with respect to the very person who taught them and confirmed all of those teachings, the Prophet himself. And his progeny and his family are the ones who are slaughtered. And not only that, but in a merciless and cruel way during this very month that was a sacred month, even in the Jahiliyyah. So the irony is in many layers, and the Imam tries to put a finger on that. Ibn Shabib, if you cry for anything, cry for Hussein ibn Ali ibn Abi Talib, for he was slaughtered as a ram is slaughtered, and along with him 18 men from his household were killed, the likes of whom are not to be found on earth. The seven layers of the sky and earth mourned his death. 4,000 angels descended to earth to aid him, only to find him already dead. Since then they remain near his grave, disheveled and dust-covered, and they will remain so until the revolution of the Mahdi. They will be his supporters, and their war cry will be, Ya Latharat al-Hussein, O the Avengers of Hussein. Alright, so Imam Rida alayhi salam, he reminds Ibn Shabib of the significance of this month, and he reminds him of the historical event that took place, that Imam Hussein was slaughtered in this merciless way as an animal is slaughtered. And he mentions that with him were these 18 men from the Ahlul Bayt, right? So from his family, cousins, nephews, sons. So the 18 men from the Ahlul Bayt, we know their names precisely, and we know their graves as well. Along with them, he says there were these companions, right? And he says that they were unmatched people, both the companions and the Ahlul Bayt. And this is something that Imam Hussein says on the eve of Ashura as well. Inshallah, we'll be able to recount to the story of that part as well, where he gathers them on the eve of the battle, and he, after giving them an opportunity to flee and encouraging them even to flee, to leave him alone and let him, let the fight be between him and Yazid, and that they can all escape. When everyone stays, then he turns to them, lets them know that they're marching to certain death, And he prays them and says that never in history has any prophet or anyone had companions like you, or had a family of supporters like you. Right? So these people are unmatched up to that time. And there's traditions from the sixth Imam's time, for instance, probably from other Imams as well, but the sixth Imam I remember, where people would come. That was a time of a lot of turmoil between the Umayyad and the Abbasid dynasty. One was falling and one was trying to get established, and there was a lot of turmoil. And so some of the Shia, they thought this was an opportunity for us to support the Imam. The Imam can finally launch the revolution they've been wanting to all these years. And so they come to the Imam and they say, you know, Imam Hussein did it with 72, right? You have thousands of supporters. And the Imam scolded them and said, how dare you compare yourself to the likes of Habib and Zuhair and these kinds of people, right? All of you together don't match even a single one of them, right? That kind of devotion they had was unmatched, and we shouldn't lightly compare ourselves to them. We should aspire, right? Aspiring is good. Hoping, praying is good, right? But to have that the gall to think that, you know, I'm pretty much the same, I'm like them, I'm as good as them, I would also support the Imam the way they did, that's foolish. So he mentions a couple of things here, supernatural events. He says that when the Imam was killed, the seven layers of the sky and the earth mourned his death. So this comes a lot in traditions. We have this kind of mention both for Imam Hussein, also for Yahya when he died. And so our scholars are split over what this means, whether there's some physical reality to this, whether it's a spiritual thing that we can't perceive, what exactly this means, or if it's just metaphorical and it's saying his death was so tragic that if the sky and earth could cry, then they would cry. That's also possible. So we don't know exactly what it means until we're able to see on the other side of the veil and see the spiritual realities of the world. We're not able to actually confirm one way or the other and know what is meant, except the fact that it's a significant event, so significant that it affects all of creation, all of existence. It's not simply the way a death of another person would be. You know, it would only affect the family members and the people who are close to the person. The death of this kind of a person affects the entire cosmos. And then he mentions that these 4,000 angels came to help him, but they found that he was already dead. Some of the traditions tell us that they came to support him early on. They came to offer their support, just like the Prophet had been given angels during the Battle of Badr and Battle of Uhud and other battles as well, where the Quran even mentions that 1,000, 5,000 angels came down to aid him. Sometimes just to make the army seem bigger than it was. It seems like, from what we understand, that the angels didn't actually fight. They were there to scare the enemy into submission and to show them that their enemy was more formidable than it was. And that was enough. If the enemy is scared, then you've already won the battle. So similarly, angels came to Imam Hussein, offered him their help, and he refused the help. Not out of arrogance. Right? We have to first kind of put a finger on what we know about the Imam and their personality and how they work before we jump to conclusions and think that, you know, how foolish to turn away help that's come to. The Imam presumably understood that the best position for him to take and the best strategy was not to seek supernatural aid to defeat his enemy. He could have. Right, Allah mentions this in the Quran so many times that people say, you know, if God is really all powerful, why does He just make us all Muslim? Right? Why does He even allow us to worship idols? And Allah says, if I wanted to, I could force you all to be Muslim, but that's not my goal. My purpose wouldn't be served in forcing you to do something. My purpose is served in giving you the potential and then giving you the opportunity. And the test, the tug of war that happens between desires and temptation and truth and logic and reason, that struggle is what's important. And he wants us to have the opportunity and then to rise voluntarily and say, I want to follow the truth despite the fact that I have desires that tell me the opposite. I want to suppress those desires and I want to follow truth regardless, despite the tug to the opposite end of the spectrum. And there's value. That's where we can achieve the perfection that Allah wants us to achieve. And so for Imam Hussein also, it's not victory, that's not the end goal. Right? Vanquishing, killing Yazid, that's not the end goal. The end goal is partly self-interest, that he wants himself to achieve those heights that the Prophet had told him he could achieve through martyrdom alone. And then to offer this opportunity for other people as well to find guidance and to choose what's right. In their case, it was a severe test, more severe than probably any of us have ever faced and maybe ever will face. To have truth be, the stakes for truth be so high that you have to sacrifice everything and put everything on the stake for the sake of truth. I don't know if you've ever faced anything like that, where choosing truth is equivalent with certain death. Right? Not only death, but the worst kind of death for yourself, and then knowledge that everything, your own family is going to be either killed if they're men, and captured if they're women. Like that kind of certain suffering and certain death was the stake and the price that they had to pay. So these 4,000 angels came, they offered their help. Imam Hussein determined that it wasn't in the best interest, right? Not out of arrogance, but because that doesn't serve the purpose properly. And so he turns away their help. Not unsimilar to his great-great-great-grandfather, Ibrahim. Right? He also, according to the traditions, when he was on the catapult being about to be thrown into the fire of Nimrod, he was also offered help by Gabriel himself. And he also refused that help. He also turned away that help and said, Allah himself has put me in this position. I put all my trust in him. If he wants to help me, let him help me directly. I don't want anything else besides God himself. And so he puts his trust completely in God. And so these same angels then presumably come back after maybe going and then coming back. And when they come back the second time, that's when they found that he's already dead. And then they remain around his grave and circulate it and these sorts of things. He continues and says, Ibn Shabib, my father reported to me from his father that his grandfather said, when Hussein was killed, blood and red earth rained down from the sky. So this is Imam Ridha saying his father, so that's Imam Kadhim, reported that his grandfather, so Imam al-Baqir, the fifth Imam, that he said the following, that one of the consequences and the physical manifestations, or I won't say physical, one of the manifestations of the death of Imam Hussein was this kind of blood and red clay falling down from the sky. And again, the same problem exists. How do we understand this? Is it something literal? It's possible. I don't know if we have historical records of that. Or it's also possible that it's a figurative way of describing the severity of this event, that it was, as you know, almost like if this could have happened, it would have happened. If the sky itself could have cried, it would have cried blood. Ibn Shabib, if you cry for Hussein until your tears flow down your cheeks, God will forgive you all the sins you have perpetrated, whether they be big or small, few or many. This sentiment is also expressed in so many traditions. The significance of these commemorations, the significance of specifically crying during the commemorations and in the memory of Imam Hussein. And this is so challenging on so many levels. On the one hand, we are now in a culture that frowns upon crying and frowns upon emotion, showing emotion in any way except frivolous ways. Right? Showing joy and happiness, that might be okay. But certainly crying is frowned upon. But it's an Islamic ideal. Right? Not only to cry for sorrow, but to cry in the fear of God. Right? To cry during prayer, to cry when you're reciting Quran, to cry when you make supplications and do ziyarah and these kinds of things. It's not only is it not a sign of weakness, it's a sign of strength, and it's a sign of humility, and a sign of closeness to Allah and purity and these kinds of things. So it's a virtue. And that's something that I think is challenging for us to try to overcome our cultural message that is to the contrary, and to reconnect with this kind of principle, this kind of virtue that we have from Islamic sources, and something that's very natural and very human, but it's denied by our culture. Not only that, but then he offers this incredible reward, and that also makes it sometimes hard to understand and hard to accept. How can something that seems so trivial, a tear, how can that have the effect of wiping clear sins? Is this exaggeration or what? Sometimes people will twist this and make it into a license to sin. Right? That's clearly not what's intended. Oftentimes they'll offer significant reward, forgiveness of all sins for a single act, a fast of a particular day, a pilgrimage to Mecca, a ziyara of this person, right? So six single events sometimes, even just tawbah itself, right? Simply repenting, right? We have traditions that say, even the Quran itself tells us that this innal hasanat yudhibna sayyi'at, a good deed will wipe away bad deeds. So how we understand it is not that this is a license to sin, that I can play a game, I can just kind of keep track and keep a tally, and as long as my good deeds outweigh my bad deeds, my tally, then I'm good to go. And if I'm a little bit on a surplus of good deeds, that means I can sin a little bit more, and as long as my good deeds are always more, then that's good. Or I can sin for a year, and then on the day of Ashura, I can come and cry, and everything will be wiped away. So it's definitely not a game. That's not the intention. That's not the spirit behind it. What's intended, what they're hoping for, is that this will be a transformative event and a transformative experience. To make this kind of a connection to Imam Hussein, that's not only rational and logical, that's important, to look at the lessons and to look at the teachings, but to also make this emotional connection with him by recounting the story, by listening to and reciting poetry, and you know, with that kind of special way that poetry affects us, and other kinds of media as well. To make that kind of a connection, that emotional connection, then becomes something very effective. That's something that can change you, transform you, that can make your life turn around completely. So to the extent that crying can touch you in such a way and affect you in such a way that you now have an emotional connection to Imam Hussein, and with it all of the ideals that go with him, the role model that he is, the servant of God that he is, and all of these things, this now has the power and the potential to transform me and make me a new person, a different person, the day after I cry versus the day before I cry. And so that's the goal that we're trying to achieve through this. It's easier said than done. Again, because of our cultural inertia, sometimes it's hard to cry. Sometimes because we'll talk a little, I wanted to talk a little about the commemoration itself. Sometimes our commemorations are also kind of clumsy. A lot of you look like you're immigrants, maybe second generation, third generation immigrants, or maybe yourself are immigrants. So you might have experience with commemorations in other countries or other cultures. So some of the countries and cultures that have done this for a while, they've gotten pretty good at it. Meaning that it's a refined art form. It's a refined form of worship now in Persian, for instance, in Urdu, in Arabic. Right? These languages and these cultures that have been doing this for a while, they have a whole canon of poetry. They have centuries of poetry of the highest quality commemorating this event. They have a whole, almost a formula for how the whole majlis happens, right? How the speaker goes from one subject to another, and how, everything's programmed in such a way, it's choreographed in such a way, it's very effective for people within that culture, and it kind of accomplishes the goal in a very refined way. We're still in a state of growing pains right now in the West. Oftentimes our poetry is still clumsy. Oftentimes our speeches are more, it has more to do with the personality of the speaker and the personality of the mix of people that are there. And so it's very kind of iffy and up and down and these kinds of things. So it'll take time before we can achieve that. So sometimes that affects our ability or inability to cry as well, and to have that emotional connection to the event. I remember a few years ago, I was at a youth gathering. It was a camp, and one person was he wrote spoken word poetry, and some other people knew, so they asked him to recite something about Imam Hussein. And I think myself and probably other people also in our mind we're kind of skeptical, thinking, is this going to be weird? Is it going to be clumsy? What is it going to turn out to be? And he started reciting this poetry, and it was amazing. And it's a group of teenagers up to 25, 30 year olds who probably never cry, and for whom crying is weird. And the whole room was in tears. Right? The way our parents, we always saw our parents cry when they heard Urdu poetry and Arabic and Persian poetry. Right? All of a sudden, this poem and this poetry of this person in a style and a language and everything that we could connect to, it had such an incredible effect. And it really affected the entire room, the atmosphere, everything was affected in such a significant way. That experience gave me so much hope that it is possible Right? Sometimes our parents' generation, they'll say, you know, you can never do it in English. You can never have a proper, you know, commemoration of Imam Hussein in English. And that's not the case. It's not the case. It's just a matter of time before we can mature as a community and develop these things organically. And inshallah, it'll come. Recite one salawat. Ibn Shabib, he says, if you wish to meet God Almighty with no sin on your record, then visit the grave of Imam Hussein. So again, another really significant reward for what seems like maybe not such a significant act, simply traveling and going to recite a ziyarah close to this grave. But again, this is something that's not only, it's not something that we have now developed. The imams themselves have established this precedent. They themselves would do whatever they could to get to Imam Hussein's grave and to do the ziyarah. They would encourage their companions to do the same. This is a significant act of worship they've always been encouraging us to do. And we see this, if you've gone through the calendar year of our acts of worship, every occasion that you can think of, there's always a ziyarah of Imam Hussein. Laylatul Qadr, I don't know, the Mab'ath of the Prophet, the 15th of Sha'ban, any of the significant days of Ramadan, any month, any event you can think of, there's always one of the many rituals, the Ghadir, one of the many rituals is a ziyarah of Imam Hussein. Right? So this is something very central. And because of that same transformative nature of this ziyarah, it has great significance. They want us to connect with him in particular, of course with all the ma'sumin, all the infallibles, but particularly with him, because his story is so compelling. It's so easy to get kind of attached to him. His story is, you know, only someone with a heart of stone would be able to know his story and not be affected. Right? So it has great potential for reforming us, and for that reason they put this kind of reward that if you want to meet Allah with no sin, then perform this one ziyarah. Again, not in that game fashion where I'll sin all my life and then do one ziyarah and everything's clean, but rather do it in a way that is transformative, like the Hajj is transformative. Right? Go there, experience this, and turn your life around from that point on. Ibn Shabib, if you wish to reside in lofty palaces in paradise with the Prophet, then pray for God to damn the murderers of Hussein. Right? La'an is the word that he uses there. Right? So La'an of the ones who were responsible for the murder of Imam Hussein. That's also part of it. So it's not all just the happy side of it, and we love Hussein and we love Allah. That's part of it. But a significant part of worship and getting close to Allah is also making sure that we're distancing ourselves from those things that are antithetical to God. And that's also very challenging for us, I think, in a pluralistic society where we have pluralistic norms and we're surrounded by people who have other attachments, other faiths or no faith at all. It becomes very, it's easy on one hand to be multicultural and be in an interfaith kind of setting. And everyone says, I believe this and I believe that, and you know, and to say all the positives about each religion. But as soon as you start to say something negative, right, to make a truth claim, for instance, and say, as Muslims, we believe that this is truth, and anything other than this is falsehood, that's when all of a sudden you start stepping on toes and becomes very uncomfortable, and people will pull away and say, you know, this is now something that's offensive to me. You're no longer just saying good things, now you're saying bad things as well, and you know, that's not the way God was, that's not the way Jesus was, that's not the way the Prophet was. And they'll make claims about God and the Prophet and paint them in a way as though they were only kind of one-sided in their truth claims. That yes, this is truth, but they never said anything about falsehood. That's historically, it's completely inaccurate. Look at the whole reason why the prophets were all killed and banished and you know, treated the way they were treated. Hardly any of the prophets were successful in any sort of sense that you can calculate. Even Imam Hussein is not successful in any sort of worldly calculation. He loses the battle. He himself is killed. Everyone's killed. Most of the prophets are like that as well. They're all banished. And you know, Prophet Nuh alayhi salam, 950 years that the Quran tells us about his prophethood, when he was actually a prophet, according to our traditions, it's 2,500 years for his lifetime. In 2,500 years of preaching and all of this, he was able to gather, the traditions say, 8 people or 80 people at most on the ark. Right, some of whom were his own family members. Right, so 8 followers after 2,500 years, and that's success. That's the success of the, successful prophet, one of the Ulul Azm prophets. Right. So this is an important part of our religion, where we have to be realistic with truth and realize that truth also has something to say about falsehood. مَاذَا بَعْدَ الْحَقِّ إِلَّا الضَّلَالِ. Besides truth, everything else is misguidance and false. Now, what do we do with that? How do we treat people who follow falsehood? That's a different question, right? That's a totally different question. The saying that a religion that is not Islamic or is atheistic or pantheistic or whatever else is false, that doesn't, it's not one and the same with saying, therefore, you know, I can be violent towards that person, or therefore I can say bad things to that person, or anything like that. What we do with that belief once we establish it and once we know truth and falsehood for ourselves, that's a different question. That has to be addressed in its own place. Right? But we shouldn't shy away from this claim. It shouldn't be a dogmatic claim. Right? But once I'm certain and I have reason and it's verifiable that something is right, then I should have the courage to defend it and make that claim and back it up with reason. Right, not simply because of frivolous reasons, because I was born into it, because I like it, because it's comfortable, but there has to be good reason before I'm willing to attach myself in that way to put everything on the line and say, I believe in this, right? Not despite the lack of evidence, but precisely because of evidence. Right, that's one of the travesties of the word belief that has now been corrupted into an acceptance of things to be true despite the lack of evidence. Right, that's usually, you don't say, I believe in, I don't know, I believe that it's day. You say, I believe that they're fairies or unicorns. Right? You only use the word belief when you're talking about something that's impossible and you have no evidence for it. Right? We should take that word back and use it in its original sense. Certainly in the Islamic sense, iman is used for believing in things, accepting things as true because of evidence, not despite the dearth of evidence. Ibn Shabib, if you wish to have the reward of one who was martyred with Hussein, then repeat, whenever you think of them, Ya laytani kuntu ma'ahum fa'afuza fawzan azima. Would that I had been with them, that I might have achieved their great victory. So this is something that we see in Arba'een, Jabir ibn Abdullah al-Ansari, from whom he's one of the companions of the Prophet who lived quite a long life, reached all the way to the fifth Imam. He's one of the first people, or maybe the first person, to visit Imam Hussein's grave on the 40th day, and that's where we get the whole Arba'een. And so he, this blind companion of the Prophet, he comes to the grave of the Imam with his guide, Ata, and he says this in his supplication and his lamentation over Imam Hussein's grave. He says that I testify that I share in your reward. And when Ata, his companion, hears this, he's like, oh, how is this possible? We didn't lift a sword. We didn't do anything. How can we make a claim that we're going to share in the reward of these people who are now dead? And so Jabir ibn Abdullah, he says, I can say this with certainty only because I heard the Prophet say it. The Prophet told me that if your intention is like this, if your intention is to be aligned with someone, to be, you know, to live and die with that person, to have died for their cause, if that's your intention, then you share in the reward that person achieved. So through alliance, through heartfelt, sincere longing to be with someone and to be kind of on the same side as them, be aligned with them, Allah is willing to give the same reward as actually being there and doing those things, if it's sincere, right? And so he says that kind of reward is there for here as well. Say this phrase. You might think, well, saying the phrase is easy, and it is easy. Actually believing in it is very difficult. But that shouldn't prevent us from saying it. Right? Just because it may not be a true statement for me. Right? I was looking at, there's a book called Al-Muraqabat. Is that a book that's familiar? I don't know if it's translated into English. Al-Muraqabat. So it's a book by Mirza Maliki Tabrizi. He's one of the great Urafa from probably like two generations ago, probably the early 1900s. And so he has a book. It goes through the calendar year, and he talks about the different spiritual significance of each year, each month of the year, and different days during the year. And so when he speaks about Muharram, he talks about this. He says, you know, you should yearn for being with Imam Hussein, the same way that Imam Ridha is telling us here. But then he says, you should only do it if you're truthful in your yearning. Right, only say this phrase, only make this claim that I wish I could have been there with you, if it's a true claim. And he says one of the ways to test yourself is the way Allah tested the Jews. In Surah Al-Jumu'ah and some other place, in Surah Al-Baqarah it's there as well, but in Surah Al-Jumu'ah Allah says, يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ هَادُوا إِن زَعَمْتُمْ أَنَّكُمْ أَوْلِيَاءُ لِلَّهِ مِن دُونِ النَّاسِ فَتَمَنَّوا الْمَوْتَ إِن كُنْتُمْ صَادِقِينَ. He says that, oh Jews, if you think that you are friends of God, right? If you think that you're friends of God, apart from other people, so you're superior to other people and you're friends of God and not other people, then he says the test, the litmus test is yearn for death. Call down death upon yourself. Say, I wish I could die and see God and, you know, be with God and achieve like everything that I've been living my life to achieve. Have that kind of intimacy with death, not to commit suicide, not that, but have that willingness that to put everything on the line and to say I'm ready for death. Or we have that phrase from Imam Ali alayhi salam where he says that I'm closer to death, I'm more familiar to death, and death is more familiar to me than the breast of a mother to a suckling child. Right? He's that kind of imagery. To show how intimately he is intimate with death, and how familiar he is with death, and how ready he is, and how much he yearns for death, only because it means that he's free from his test, and now he can achieve all the fruits of his labors. Right. So the Quran puts that challenge for the Jews as well. That if you're sincere in your claims and you truly think that you and not other people are awliya and friends of God, then seek death for yourself. And so Mirza Maliki Tabrizi says, use this test for yourself. You make this claim that I wish I could have been with Imam Hussein. I could have suffered. I could have, you know, if I could have died instead of him, if I could have suffered a little and through my suffering, he could be alleviated of some of his suffering. We're making that kind of a claim. So it's one of the ways to test whether you're sincere is see whether how willing you are to actually face death. And it's quite challenging. If you do it sincerely, think about those who have children, or those who are married, right? It's one thing to think about your own death. It's sometimes easier to think about what would happen if your child, if it was your child that you had to put on the line, or your spouse, right? The way Imam Hussein had to do, right? That becomes very, very significant. It's quite challenging if you think, am I really ready for it? If I had to go and, you know, drop everything and lay down my life for Allah, would I be willing to do it the way these people were willing to do it? So we can aspire, and we should aspire, and try to achieve that, but also be very honest with ourselves and realize that it's a very lofty claim. The last phrase of the Imam in this tradition, he says, Ibn Shabib, if you would like to be with us, the Ahlul Bayt, at our loftiest of stations in paradise, then be joyful when we feel joy and be aggrieved when we feel grief. فَحْزَنْ لِحُزْنِنَا وَفْرَحْ لِفَرَحِنَا. That's a beautiful phrase as well. And hold fast to our authority. Let's talk about that one phrase. So he says, he wants us to have that kind of alignment, that emotional connection with them. So yes, we talked about reason and logic. That has to be there. To determine who the Imam is and whether they have rightful claims or not, there's logic, there's history, those kinds of investigative efforts that we have to go through to be able to determine that yes, their claims are true, yes, they are qualified, and those kinds of things. Those are logical endeavors that we have to engage in. But beyond that, and once that is determined, then we need to push the envelope and develop this emotional connection with them. Right? So it's one thing to have a logical mind and say, yes, they're definitely the Imam, here are the reasons. Yes, they have these, here are their traits, and to be able to recount those traits in a robotic sort of a way. It's another thing to have such attachment to them that when they feel joy, I feel joy simply because they're joyful. Not because I have any direct cause for joy, but simply because of their joy. And if they're sad, I feel sad only because of their sadness. I find that very challenging as well. I see that mothers, I think, at least in my experience, the mothers that I have known, I think they have an ability to do that sometimes, in a much better way than at least I'm able to do. Where I've seen mothers who can be happy just because their child is happy, and feel pain just because they see their child has stubbed their toe or is bleeding or something like that, and the mother feels sick to her stomach because of that. To have that kind of attachment to the Ahlul Bayt, that's one of the goals. And hold fast to our authority, he says, for if a person were to ally with even a stone, then God would raise him in its ranks on Judgment Day. So alliances are extremely important. Right? Not only your own actions, that's also important, what you do for yourself, but also who you ally with, who your friends are. There's a lot of advice that comes, an admonishment that comes through a hadith that says that we should be really careful about the company that we choose to keep. And that judgment, our own judgment as individuals, happens not only based on our own record, but also on the record of those who are around us. So if the company I keep is of low character, then I'm also liable for their low character and their low actions, simply because I kept their company. Right, so alliances are extremely important. Right, we're told, for instance, not to put ourselves in positions where our character comes under question. So to be in a place, to put yourself in a position, to dress in a way, to associate yourself in a way with people where someone passing by, someone, you know, just seeing a snapshot of what you're doing or what you look like or who you're hanging around with, that gives them the impression, even the thought that, you know, maybe he's also like that, maybe he's also associated with these people. I didn't realize he also does that kind of stuff. Right? Even that thought, yes, the person shouldn't have, you know, shouldn't think pessimistically. That's what, you know, one issue. But also, I as a person shouldn't put myself in a position. The phrase that's used in a hadith is "La talumanna illa nafsak." Don't blame anyone but yourself if you put yourself in that position. Right. So it's important that we align ourselves correctly and wisely with the people. We can use that principle to our advantage. If we're going to be judged with our company, why not keep the best of company? Keep company with people that are far better than you or I. Right? If I keep better company, then the principle will still kick in. I'll be judged with them. So even the characteristics that I don't have, Allah will give me credit for it because I chose to keep company of people who are much better than I am. And of course it'll have... Yeah, please. And of course it rubs off. We're influenced all the time by people around us. And if we keep that kind of company, then we have a far greater chance of reaching those aspirations because now we have role models, and we have people who are encouraging us to do better than we are, to be better than we are. So that's a great principle to act on. Recite with salawat. I wanted to take a little bit of time just to speak about the commemoration itself. I said some things. It's important to think about the commemoration and realize what we're doing and what the significance of these commemorations is. And if we do that, then it gives more significance to the commemoration itself, and it gives us a sense of purpose as well. And we really understand how this fits into the bigger picture of our activities as Muslims. So like I mentioned, we have... one of the challenges for many of our communities, this is actually the first time I've spoken during Muharram at a gathering like this at a university. Typically, I'll go to more traditional communities that are immigrant-based. At least the founders typically in our centers tend to be immigrants. There are very few centers that we have or Shi'i masajid that are founded by converts or indigenous Shias. They're coming up, and there'll be more and more, inshallah. But presently, just because of our demographics, it tends to be that the founders of centers and the ones who have set the tone, they tend to be immigrants. And with that comes certain strengths and certain weaknesses. So we have the influence of foreign cultures that comes into our centers, and then the flavor and the manifestation of these commemorations also is a reflection of those foreign cultures. And that's great in a way. That's a strength in one way, because to start out with a vacuum and create culture from a vacuum is artificial, and it's extremely difficult, if not impossible. Right? So to have a starting material and to kind of have influences from something and then let it grow organically, that's really the way things should happen, the way things do happen. But the challenge then is that sometimes things are culturally relevant to a certain time and place, and then when it's uprooted and transferred to another place, it doesn't take. Like a transplant, it doesn't always take. And so there are aspects of those foreign cultures that we find relevance in, and there are aspects that are irrelevant. Language tends to be a big issue, right? Where foreign languages are often used, and because of that, because of the fact that the foreign language is used as a medium of communication, the audience is limited, the effect is limited, mainly to those immigrants. The children can't benefit. And most of you, I would assume probably many of you faced that similar challenge if you were immigrants, that you grew up sometimes in a community where things were happening in languages that you weren't familiar with, or at least it wasn't your first language that you could connect with in a way that was as strong as if it had been English. And then, of course, converts and indigenous Muslims who have no foreign connections, they're going to be lost in those kinds of communities. Mm-hmm. So this has been a huge challenge in our regular kind of centers. University is unique, right? We have our own challenges. It's really important. I don't know if you, I'm sure you've realized the significance of this event. And from emails that I saw from other people, like who are not even attached here, I saw emails from other states, other places of people who are always excited about new endeavors. They are so excited about this event happening, because it gives hope to people to see that something at on this scale could happen at a university, with university sanction, university support, and then the diversity that you all bring to the gathering, and then I would assume the diversity of speakers that you also bring in. I know some of the people who have come before. So it's a great thing. The fact that you have commemoration, I didn't get to hear all the poetry because I came in late, but to have poetry developed and recited, and for that art form to develop in our language is so important, right? Not to simply translate things or resort to foreign languages to commemorate. Oftentimes, even if there's an English lecture at a masjid, when it comes to the masaib, they switch back to a foreign language because it's much more comfortable and people can connect with it emotionally better. Very rarely will you hear it done in English, and even the poetry and all will be in foreign languages. So it's very important, and hopefully you realize that importance, not only for poetry but other forms of art, where we're supposed to connect with these things. The principle is we need to commemorate Imam Hussein in a way that's in keeping with and promoting his message, and that we only connect to that message and those themes in an emotional way as well. Right, those are the principles. Those are the kind of that's the framework we have to work with. Now, how we do that, it happens in different ways in different times. Right? So it doesn't have to necessarily only be poetry. There are other art forms as well. One of the most eye-opening experiences I had was I went to Bahrain 1 year for Muharram for the first 10 days. It was before all the trouble in Bahrain started. So the Shi'i were still quite free at that time, or at least as free as you can be in one of those dictatorships. But they're relatively free to practice. The group that invited me, they were like third generation or fourth generation Irani immigrants to Bahrain. And it was a couple of brothers who had realized that there's a huge need for holding these commemorations for people who don't speak these languages. So they're expatriates, you know, spouses of people who are working in Bahrain, immigrant workers who would be brought in from East Asia and whatever, and then marry into Shi'i husbands. And so there's quite a big population of non-Arabic, non-Persian, non-Urdu speaking converts. And so they decided they wanted to do something to try to reach out to them and provide something for them. It was one of the most enlightened group of people I'd ever seen amongst in the Shi'i community. And it was surprising to me to see that happen in Bahrain. Right, not in America. And so they put their entire program, it was so well thought out. The downtown of Manama, the capital, the inner city, kind of the poorer areas that would be completely overrun and taken over by Muharram commemorations and all the different Husseiniyas. And the publicity that the government would give, they would warn the expatriates not to go here because there are these thugs that roam the street, and they'll beat you up, and they would say all sorts of things. Don't eat their food because they spit in it before they serve it to you. And these kinds of rumors would be generated to try to keep everyone out of that place. So what these guys did, they decided that because people have this fear, let's not put our thing right in the heart of everything. We'll put it right on the edge. So on the edge of that city, they put up a huge tent, rented a lot and put up a huge tent. And so it was very welcoming. You didn't have to go deep into all the activity of Muharram commemorations. You could park your car and come right into the tent. And so it felt safe. So that kind of thinking. They thought maybe it's hard for people to sit on the floor, so let's put chairs. They filled the whole, it was like a circus tent, like that kind of size of a tent. They filled it with hundreds of chairs. And everything was English. Even though English wasn't their first language, they themselves, the people who organized it, they were clumsy with English. But they decided that English had to be the medium. And just everything that was done was so well thought out. They organized a tour, like a candlelight tour, of the downtown area for people after the program, where they'd take a group of people and they'd walk them through, tell them about Ashura and Karbala, and take them into Husseiniya, show them the kitchen, show them how spotless the kitchen was, and just try to break down all those barriers and all those obstacles that people had because of the negative propaganda. Right, so that they had a shadow. One of the things they did for the commemoration of the story, they put on a shadow play. It was so creative. Yeah, they had a whole script, they had someone narrating it, and so they didn't have to depict the face in case people were sensitive to having the faces and stuff. So they came up with a shadow play. Just really, really enlightening ways of doing things. And that's what we have to do. Right, that's our challenge. And here is a great place to start that. Engage in these efforts to both recite poetry and write poetry, create other ways of commemorating the event of passing out, kind of like spreading the ideas and spreading the message and these kinds of things, right? The opportunities are endless. One of the events that they had in Bahrain, they had a whole art studio in the middle of the downtown area where they had art supplies for anyone to come in and paint anything they wanted about Imam Hussein. So the full studio, the canvases, you take a canvas, take your paints, and they had hundreds of paintings all around of people, just whatever they wanted to do. They depict different stories, symbolism, just different kinds of things. And some of them were beautiful. There's different interesting ways of getting people to connect with this in both a rational and intellectual way and also in a very emotional way. All right, recite one salawat, please. I want to finish by recounting a story from a little bit before Karbala. So in terms of our history, Karbala takes place in the beginning of the year 61. Right, Muharram of 61. This story goes back 1 year and 1 month, or possibly 2 years and 1 month, before the day of Ashura. So this is the day of Eid al-Adha, and Mina, in the year 58 or 59. So just before this time, there was a slight weakening in the power of Muawiyah, who was still the ruler, but his health was failing. There had been an uprising in Kufa and Basra led by the Khawarij. And so because of these different factors, there was a loosening of his grip on the Muslim lands. So Imam Hussein, he felt that this was a good time to reach out to people. Hajj in that time, and throughout many of the Imam's times, was what it should have been. It was a time for, it was an international conference. It was a time to get people together, to reach out to them, to proselytize, to collect taxes, to network, to find out about what's happening, for people to ask questions. And so at Mina, in that tent city of Mina, the Imam sends out his companions, and he asks them to go and find the companions of the Prophet, who are still alive, and find the Tabi'een, who are the next generation, so the students of the companions of the Prophet, not those who directly saw the Prophet, but those who were students of the direct companions of the Prophet. And of course, his whole Ahlul Bayt, meaning all his cousins, and Ibn Abbas is there, Abdullah ibn Ja'far is also there. So he ends up collecting in his tent and around his tent 200 companions, who actually were with the Prophet, and 700 tabi'een from the next generation of students, plus his Ahlul Bayt. He gathers them all together and he asks them a series of questions, and he gets them to recognize and admit who he is and who the Ahlul Bayt are. So he asks them all sorts of rhetorical questions. He says, for instance, do you know about Ayatul Tathir? Right, verse 33, 33, إِنَّمَا يُرِيدُ اللَّهُ لِيُذْهِبَ عَنْكُمْ الرِّجْسَ أَهْلَ الْبَيْتِ وَيُطَهِرَكُمْ تَطْهِيرًا. Do you know this verse? And do you know this verse refers to me and my family? And all of them resoundingly said, yes, we know that. He recites Ayatul Mawadda, that I ask only for your devotion to my family, your love for my family. Do you know this is about me and my family? He said, they all say, yes, we know that. He tells them about the event of Mubahala and recites the verse in the Quran where it says that you call your sons and our sons and your women and our women and yourselves and ourselves, and then we'll have this contest of to see who's right, and we'll call down God's damnation on the one who's lying. And he says, do you know that the ones that the Prophet brought to that Mubahala were myself and my mother and my father and my brother? And of course they say, yes, we know all of this. He talks about Ghadir. He recounts the events of Ghadir and says, do you know that this was with regard to my father, that he is the one who is has primacy over all the believers? And again they say, yes, we know all of this. So he goes through event after event. He talks about the building of the houses. He says, do you remember that when the Prophet moved to Medina, he had 10 houses built around the masjid, right? 9 of them were for himself and his wives, and one of them right in the middle was for Fatima and Ali. And they say, yes, we know this. And do you know that all the houses that were built around the masjid, the Prophet had all of their doors closed so they couldn't enter into the masjid directly anymore. They'd have to go around to the main entrance, except for his own door and the door of Ali. He left those two open so they could access the masjid directly. And this became a big deal. In the same hadith, he says that Umar ibn Khattab, he had expressed a wish to the Prophet that if only I had a peephole into the masjid left for me, that would be enough for me. But even that was denied. And this became a significant issue, and they would complain to the Prophet, and he would say, I'm not the one who made this ruling. God himself told me to close all the doors except for Ali's and mine. And they say, yes, we know all of this. He asked them, do you know that Ali used to have private sittings with the Prophet twice on a daily basis, one in the morning, one in the evening. On a daily basis, he would sit with the Prophet. The Prophet would tell him all of the new revelation that had come down. Imam Ali would write it as the Prophet dictated it. The Prophet would check, and the Prophet would tell him whatever he needed to know, all the tafsir, all the different applications of the verse, and Imam Ali would write everything, the Prophet would inspect everything. Do you know all of this? And they said, yes, we know all of this. So he asks them all these questions, and then he tells them that despite the fact that you know about Ali, and you know the significance of us as the Ahlul Bayt, right, you have failed in these years. The reason why someone like Muawiyah can rule in the way he's ruling is because of your shortcomings as companions and tabi'een. You have a position in the hearts of people where you could use that position, use that power to speak out against Muawiyah, to fight against him, and people would follow you if only you had to have the courage to do it. But you failed, and because of your failure, someone like Muawiyah can do what he's doing. And so he calls on them and he asks them to get a sense of their alignment. He says, if I were to make a call, if I were to rise up, would you be with me or not? And so all these people, they say yes. The companions, the tabi'een, the Ahlul Bayt, they all say yes, we would support you, we'd be with you. This is the time that Muawiyah's health is failing, his kingdom is crumbling, and this is the time to rise up against him. If you fast forward now to the day of Ashura, Imam Hussein has a very similar sermon to the Kufans. On that day also, he reminds them of the same events. And there are probably people who were at Mina 2 years before. There were companions amongst the Kufans who were facing off with Imam Hussein. So maybe some of those same people were there, and he asked the same kinds of questions. He says, this turban that I wear, do you recognize that this is the turban, Sahab, that the Prophet used to wear? the sword that is in my scabbard. This is the sword of the prophet. Do you recognize the clothing that I'm wearing? Do you recognize that this is the abba of the prophet that I now have on my shoulders? And the Kufans resoundingly, question after question, they say, yes, we recognize that. Yes, we know this. Yes, we know this. Do you know that the prophet said that I and my brother are Sayyida Shababi Ahl al-Jannah, where the leaders, the masters of all the youth of paradise? They say, yes, we know this. So one after the other, they affirm, they testify. All of them had either directly heard it from the prophet, witnessed these things being revealed, witnessed these traditions being said by the prophet, or at least they had heard through reliable sources to the point that they had no doubt that this was all true. But the response that comes on the day of Ashura is very different. The response he had gotten at that time, when there was no commitment necessary, when it was just a movement of the tongue, it was easy for them to say, yes, we'll support you. But here on the battlefield, with someone like Ibn Ziyad in Kufa, threatening their families, having executed certain individuals who were companions of Ali in gruesome ways, crucifying them, muzzling them, with the threats he has on their families, on their wealth, that he'll destroy them, destroy their memory if they don't support him. So now the Kufan's response is very different. And they say, we know all of this, but we have sworn that we will not let you leave this battlefield until you die thirsty. As-salamu alayka ya Aba Abdillah wa ala al-arwah allati halat bifinaik alayka minni salamullahi abadan ma baqit wa baqiya al-laylu wa an-nahar ولا جعله الله آخر العهد مني لزيارتكم السلام على الحسين وعلى علي بن الحسين وعلى أولاد الحسين وعلى أصحاب الحسين. Allah, we ask you to shower your mercy and blessings on Muhammad and the family of Muhammad. Allah, accept these acts of devotion that we are attempting to present before you. Help us to commemorate Imam Hussein in a way that is worthy of him. Help us to commemorate his martyrdom in a way that brings us closer to you. Forgive us for our sins, for our meager efforts. Help us to live a life that is in keeping with the principles and the example of Hussein and the Ahlul Bayt. Allow us and avail us of their intercession on the Day of Judgment. Help us to be worthy of avenging his death along with his heir and his successor, Imam Mahdi, ajalallahu ta'ala faraja. Let us be with him, be his supporters, to avenge the death of Hussein, and to stand for everything he stood for and against all that he stood against. Wa akhiru da'wana alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen.